On our minds this week is simmering racial tension in America and Claudia Rankine's popular new book-length poem about race. It was nominated for a National Book Award, and it's selling like crazy, which is pretty rare for poetry. The cover is simple. It's a black hoodie set against a white background, and the title, Citizen, an American Lyric. Claudia Rankine sat down with Charles Monroe Kane to talk about it.
If the hoodie's juxtaposition to the word citizen complicates the word citizen, then, you know, that's a problem. I think the use of the word citizen for me is sort of synonymous with American. And if, as an American, you're not allowed to basically walk the streets without being concerned for your life, then, you know, it's a kind of problem.
It's amazing. It always seems to me that the hoodie has become something we replace with black, because you can't get away, right, in the modern world of being racist, but you can get away with being against the hoodie, right?
Right. But, you know, it's funny because white people wear hoodies. But, you know, the fact that it's a symbol that loses its toxicity when it's put on the white body is also very interesting.
Do you have something you could read for us from your book that you feel gets at part of this?
Okay. You and your partner go to see the film The House We Live In. You ask a friend to pick up your child from school. On your way home, your phone rings. Your neighbor tells you he is standing at the window watching a menacing black guy casing both your homes. The guy is walking back and forth, talking to himself, and seems disturbed. You tell your neighbor that your friend, whom he has met, is babysitting. He says, no, it's not him. He's met your friend, and this isn't that nice young man. Anyway, he wants you to know he's called the police. Your partner calls your friend and asks him if there's a guy walking back and forth in front of your home. Your friend says that if anyone were outside, he would see him because he is standing outside. You hear the sirens through the speakerphone. Your friend is speaking to your neighbor when you arrive home. The four police cars are gone. Your neighbor has apologized to your friend and is now apologizing to you. Feeling somewhat responsible for the actions of your neighbor, you clumsily tell your friend that the next time he wants to talk on the phone, he should just go in the backyard. He looks at you a long minute before saying he can speak on the phone wherever he wants. Yes, of course, you say. Yes, of course. I like the ending of that piece because one of the things that I think happens with racism is that everybody's response then gets complicated by trying to avoid it or, you know, move away from it. So, you know, that actually happened to me. And when I said to our friend, you know, the next time you should just go in the backyard, I meant it as a way of avoiding the aggressions and the fear and the paranoia of our neighbor. But in a sense, I was telling him that he should curtail his own rights.
Well, let me ask a different question here. And I want to talk to you about pronouns. Your use of you and I, and again, the you and I always assumed when I first started reading the book was someone who was black. And then he and she that I assumed was white. So that's how I read it. And then things started to get really muddied about a third of the way through the book. And then I was like, wait a minute, who is she talking about here? Is this about me? Is it about the black community? And so I guess it begs the question, who is this book for and who is it not for?
Well, it's for Americans. It's for citizens. And the use of the second person was intentional. What I wanted to achieve structurally was a environment where people would have to orientate themselves relative to the pronoun.
Right.
Because you often hear people say, you know, I don't think about race. I just see people. So I wanted people to read these pieces and see their own minds place one body in a black body or a brown body, place another body in a white body, see themselves relative to that situation and say, oh, wait, I did this. I didn't do this. I would never do this. I clearly am not that person. I've never received that treatment, you know, et cetera. And see if in their own minds they lined up the participants according to race.
There's another poem in your book that really struck me, and I think it's a poem you added in way after it was published and had a new publication so you could put Eric Garner and Michael Brown in. It's a very powerful poem, and it says, "In memory of Jordan Russell Davis, in memory of Eric Garner, in memory of Joan Crawford, in memory of Michael Brown, in memory, in memory, in memory, in memory." And it goes on till it fades. And then it says, "Because white men can't police their imagination, black men are dying." Could you tell me about that poem?
That was written in response to Darren Wilson. When he said that thing, that seeing Michael Brown was like seeing Hulk Hogan, that he was a demon, I don't disbelieve him. I think that for him, the black body is this thing that is larger than life. Even though he, you know, Michael Brown is bigger than him in terms of weight, but I think they're relatively the same height. So I wrote that down as a line, because white men can't police their imagination, black men are dying, thinking that it would lead to other lines. But I got stuck there because it seemed to be at the heart of the problem.
Yeah.
That the ways in which the racial imagination is created, has been created for whiteness and blackness in this country, you know, it has at its root this kind of, this sense of fear and loathing, basically, of the other.
Now, you went down to Ferguson, right, before the grand jury decision. What was that like?
When I went, I just happened to be in St. Louis, and so I went to Ferguson, and it was very sad, actually. I ran into some young black men, and one of them kept saying to me, "I look just like Michael Brown. That could be me." So that sense of identification with a dead body was something I wanted to run from. You know, I found it really appalling. And then I ran into another woman, and she had a toddler with her. And she said to me, "Do you want to take a picture of the boy with his hands up in the air?" And again, I felt like, no, I don't. I don't want to take a picture of your toddler in the hands up, don't shoot position, because I don't want that analogy determining his life. And so in a sense, that's me being a little bit in denial about a kind of reality that is true for, you know, for black men in this country, and definitely for black boys and men who live in Ferguson.
You know, you're a professor in California, and you're very intelligent, and you've lived life, and you knew before that grand jury decision what that decision was going to be. What was that like, too? You knew they were going to be acquitted, right?
I knew they were going to be acquitted, and I wanted them to be indicted. So, so there was still that 1% of me hoping. And I think if I didn't continue to go forward with the 1%, then I don't know how quiet I would live, you know? And I think this is true, you know, I don't want to speak for all black people, I don't know, but certainly for me, there was and continues to be, again and again in these situations, a kind of jaded, I know they're going to be acquitted, I know they're going to be acquitted, and yet this private hope that they will be indicted. So that's why you wait. You know, you're in this constant sense of waiting, and the wait becomes like years and years and years and years until it's a lifetime.
You are a poet, a purveyor of words. Is this book the words for that wait?
I think these are the words for that wait. I think the book, for me, was a very personal exploration of what it feels to live the wait and what it looks like.
What are the words that we need? I mean, the big we, right? Capital W, the United States. What are some of the words we need to move beyond this?
I think that discussion, that the fact that we're now talking about it, and going alongside of that always has, obviously, to be that legislation has to stand alongside. But it doesn't change the hearts of people. It doesn't change that sense that I think I believe one thing and then I act in another way, hence the lack of indictments in moments when it seems very clear and obvious and sensible what should happen. So I think people, you know, we have to just keep talking, because we all are here together.
Claudia Rankine's new book is called Citizen, An American Lyric. Charles Monroe Kane talked with her.